Mr. Forbes at 11. We were talking about the Ardennes offensive, yeah, you know, and yeah. You mentioned one incident where you fired at a self-propelled gun. You don't know whether you hit it or not, but well, the other incident you were about to recall.
There's one or two casualties there, but it wasn't any real emergencies there, from what I can remember. It was cold and there was no snow. It was really beautiful countryside, and it was a shame that we couldn't enjoy it. But one incident, I couldn't remember, we stopped at, I think we were on the way back, and we stopped at an estaminet, a little, like a country pub. And the proprietor there invited us all into his big, he had a big function room, and we got in there to sleep. And he had a big fireplace there, but no fuel for it. So we took the tanks and went into the weeds and pushed over several trees. And we all enjoyed the exercise in the cold, you know, stripped to the waist and with our axes and chopping up these trees and fuel these fire. And he was so grateful that he provided us with drinks. And that was where I was introduced to pastis, which is a sort of liqueur drink. So that was a very merry occasion that on the way home, because we had just been enjoying almost skiing down the slopes with the Shermans.
I wanted to talk to you about that because some people said it was very difficult to drive once it got icy and snowy, you know, when the snow started.
That was true on icy roads and things. You might slide off the road. But on this occasion, we were coming down an open hillside and we were all in line coming down there. And each driver was having a bit of fun pulling on, you know, left stick and skidding around. Sometimes you go right round. You face the other way. But the tracks were so good in snow and ice because there was quite a grip there, you know. It was like a car with chains on. Anyway, we waltzed our way down that mountainside till we got to the bottom, and it was very enjoyable. Exhilarating, actually.
And what about when you did have problems on the icy roads? Was there a problem with skidding off the roads or anything like that?
Well, you had to be careful not to steer, not to oversteer when you were on these sort of ice. Especially if there was any camber or anything on the roads, you would slide into the side. But I can't recall anybody having any trouble getting home from the Ardennes.
Did you have snow chains and things, or the equivalent?
Not on a track vehicle. I mean, it's got enough gripping power with these bars across the tracks. You didn't need anything like that.
Now, so you went back to Ypres,
yeah.
And at Ypres, the big thing that you went back into billets, I presume. Did you go to the same billets?
There was one little incident I've forgotten that I could recall here. On the way up to the Ardennes, we were out in the open somewhere, and there was a tailor craft, a little tailor craft plane, you know, spotter plane.
German or British?
British. It came round in circles, and it obviously was observing us, and he landed in a field not much bigger than this, you know. Never seen anybody land so quickly in such short space. And this American came out looking like some American in a gangster film. But he had a soft hat on, fedora or something you call it, and a cigar in his mouth. And he came across, a leather jacket and everything. Came across and he shouted to the enemy, you guys had any Christmas dinner? Well, this was Christmas Day, you see? And he said, no. He said, all right. And he went away back to his plane and he took off in just the same short space. And a while later, four trucks came up with these insulated hot things, you know, in the back. And we went where I messed in, and we got a little bit of turkey and things. Yeah, it was very nice. And this was American hospitality, and, you know. That was on the way up to the Ardennes. It was worth, an occasion worth remembering. The Americans were probably good at that sort of thing. We're on our way home now. We got back to Ypres and we discovered that our Christmas fair, which had been locked up and evidently had been stolen.
Who by?
By the locals, of course. And nobody was offended, because they were starving people, so it was good for them. And the OC or the CO or someone called up RASC or something, and they sent up another load of stuff for Christmas stuff. So we had our Christmas dinner on the 25th of January, I think it was.
Well, how traditional a Christmas dinner was it?
Well, basic, just basic turkey and cabbage and stuffing, potatoes, the usual sort of Christmas dinner. There was no complaints about that. And of course, traditionally, the officers serve, the men sit at the tables and the officers really serve them, as it always happens apparently on Christmas Eve in the army. Anyway, it was quite enjoyable. So that was Christmas in Ypres.
Was there much drinking at Christmas? Well,
no,
January.
Not a lot. There was sort of weak Belgian beer to be had in the pubs and that. But Bob Haynes and I, we found a little place to enjoy our evening. And there was two girls here. Rachel and Mariette. And they wanted to learn ballroom dancing. And you see, that was Bob's thing. He was a trombone player in the dance band, and he was an excellent dancer. So we used to go around there every night while we went and played.
Was this in the Staminae? Or
the Staminae, yeah. There was a lot of them.
What were they like? Can you describe one and what they offered you?
Well, this particular one had a nice big sort of place where there had been a lounge, but it had been. But because of the war, I think the Germans took away a lot of the furniture. I don't know what they did with it, but they took it away. And it was empty. Plenty of space to dance in. And sort of seats all round. And they managed to get hold of drinks from somewhere.
What would you drink?
Well, just Belgian beer. It's kind of like lager, was mostly all we had. Nothing. And sometimes the father and the mother would appear with a bottle of wine or something, you know, Calvados or wine or something like that. That was the only other thing we could get.
Did you like the Belgian? I mean, it was what you were used to.
I liked them, yeah.
The beer?
The beer, no. Well, I wasn't what you would call a connoisseur of beer. But it was sort of slightly bitter lager tasted stuff. Not to my taste, but I suppose if you drunk enough of it, you would get some effect from it.
Did you drink much?
No, not a lot. No.
What about New Year's Eve? I mean, that's the big Scottish celebration. Was that? I mean, you were in the Ardennes, but
that was a flop. Really, we couldn't do anything. We didn't have anything to do anything with. I suppose some of the tanks had reserve of Calvados that was stored away, but we didn't have anything like that.
Now, the big thing that happened was at Ypres was that the tanks, the new tanks, the Comets.
Yeah.
Now, could you describe the Comet, how it differed from the Sherman and what you thought of it?
I think it was a revelation to us, the speed, the non-maintenance engine. It was a Rolls-Royce, the same as the Spitfire, same engine as the Spitfire, and it was sealed. There was nothing to do on it. It was all, never had a bit of trouble with it. And that was one of the good things about the Comet, the engine was no trouble at all. No, I don't think anybody ever broke down with them. I don't know, but I don't think so. If they broke down, it was something caused by the enemy or something. And the speed of it was something we enjoyed too. The fact that you get some acceleration was terrific. You could take off pretty quickly.
It was faster than the Sherman, was it?
Faster than the Sherman.
How much faster?
Yeah, it was, I think it was governed to 42 miles an hour, but some of them, the governor wasn't all that good, and you could get up to 45. On a slope, you probably got up to 50, I don't know.
What were they like to drive compared to the Sherman?
Lovely, yeah.
What did the controls differ in any way? Or?
Well, instead of having two handles like that, I think you had two like that, sort of.
Bent round grips.
Bicycle thing. There was not a great deal of difference. Changing gear was easier.
Why?
A better gearbox, I should think. More, what's the word, synchronization with the clutch in the gearbox. It was a better vehicle, mechanically, all round.
What about the height? Because it was a lower tank, wasn't it?
It was lower, yeah.
Was that an advantage?
It was more difficult getting in and out.
Why was that?
I think you went in at the side, didn't you? No, you went in at the side. You didn't have anything above.
No hatches?
No hatches. Oh, well, you had a door, so more of a door than a hatch that you shut.
Could you not drive with your head up then?
No.
So you looked through
a panel, yeah.
And what about the armour and the gun?
Well, the armour was thicker. The turret was cast, I think. It wasn't the Cromwell. The plates were sort of bolted and riveted, whereas the Comet had a cast turret. You know, it was solid. Thicker, and...
Is this thicker than the Sherman or than the Cromwell?
I think it was thicker than the Sherman. I wouldn't like it to be... I'm not sure of that.
Did you feel the armour was better than the Sherman?
You felt that this was what you wanted from the start. If you'd had this from the start, it would have been a little bit pleasanter.
What about the gun? Because you'd had the 17-pounder, now you had the 76mm.
It was 77, wasn't it?
Whatever, I may have got that wrong.
Well, anyway, it fired a 17-pounder shell, I think, which meant you had almost the same velocity, probably just the same.
As the Firefly?
As the Firefly, yes. Yeah. But we all had it, so it was every tank had it, which was a big difference too.
It was back to the Beesa machine guns. What did that matter?
Back to the Beesa. Well, they were reliable guns. Probably just as good as the Browning. But I think the one thing was maybe the barrels didn't last quite so long or something. You need a gunner to tell you.
We'll tell you. And you would have a co-driver again, presumably.
Yeah, we did. That's
Do you know who it was?
And I can't even remember who he was. I think it was somebody called McCafferty. McCafferty was was Liverpool or something came from. And he's one of these versatile sort of chaps who could pick up an instrument and play a tune on, you know. And he found a set of bagpipes someplace, and he used to, when we got a chance, he would be out. And he played all the popular tunes on the bagpipes.
You don't know his first name.
Louis Danube, that was his favourite tune.
On the bagpipes.
On the bagpipes. And he also ate razor blades. I don't know how he did it, but he put a razor blade in his mouth and eventually spat out all the little bits where he chewed it. It was a gimmick that he picked up, I don't know.
You don't know his first name, though, just McCafferty.
Just McCafferty, I can't remember his first name. I don't think we ever gave him a first name. He would be Mark or something like that.
And he fitted well into the...
Yeah, in a light-hearted sort of way. Yeah.
Did you go up on the firing practices at Gravelines?
No, I was not on that, no.
What about? Did you visit the First World War battlefields or the cemeteries?
I never had the chance of that. No. Past them, we saw the signpost, a little indication that it was the cemetery there, but never.
And what about, were you there when Montgomery visited? He came for a medal presentation.
No, I wasn't there.
So anything else about Ypres before you moved off? Because you went off for a training at Montagu and then up to the crossing of the Rhine.
Well, there was the usual rule there. I always felt it was nice to get out and do a bit of marching and drawing. I quite liked it because it loosened you up, and there was a big inspection that the Brigadier Harvey came.
Roscoe Harvey.
Aye, he came and inspected us there, and we lined up all dressed up in the best battle dress and everything in the middle of Ypres, and it was a spectacle for the civilians to enjoy too, I suppose. I wasn't very impressed. It was a lovely place with all these big, huge, magnificent buildings, which had been completely rebuilt after the First World War, and they were very nice. We enjoyed it. We enjoyed walking about in the Ukraine, and there was the Men in Gate, which we had a big service there. A lovely band from the 10th Royal Hussars band. We had a nice service there, which the civilians again part in, and it was
really nice. The next thing is, you went to Montagu for training. Do you remember do you remember much about that?
I remember being on a transporter, a big white transporter. And the crew of the transporter occasionally stopped off and picked up a Fräulein or something. Yeah.
What were the transporters like?
I drove one actually, because we were supposed to stay in the tank, in the turret. The crew was supposed to stay in the tank, because there wasn't any real accommodation on the truck for us. It was it was almost an Arctic vehicle, if I remember right. I'm not very sure, but I think the back portion that contained the tank was a sort of separate part of the vehicle.
It would just take one tank.
Just take one tank, yeah. I mean, that was a fairly heavy load. But there were nice vehicles to drive. The American white. They had about 5 forward gears and 2 reverse or something like that, you know, and a booster. You could go get half a gear with a booster. They were good to drive. You know.
Now, what about the crossing of the Rhine? What do you remember of that?
That was I really enjoyed the sights there, because it was Buffalo's crossing as well. That's the amphibian tank. And the bridge was a magnificent Royal Engineers design. You know, it was a pontoon bridge right across, and maybe 3/4 of a mile or something across that bit, I can't remember. But you were a long time on the bridge, and what impressed me was as you went over, you saw as the tracks hit each pontoon went down almost submerged. Till you go over. Very sort of flexible, the whole thing. I enjoyed that particular moment of two.
How much leeway did you have on either side?
Not very much. No, the tank was quite wide. But of course, a tank is something that, being equal on both sides, if you sat like this, you would have gone across without steering, dead straight.
So once you got it going straight, it would carry on straight.
Yeah.
So you weren't nervous on the thing.
More or less, unless you hit some kind of an obstacle.
Now, what happened when you got over the other side?
No, I'm not quite sure. I think we just moved forward into a gathering place, as it were. An assembly place, ready for the next advance. I think we might have had a bit of spare time there, I'm not quite sure. before we moved on into Germany. I mean, when you crossed the bridge, you weren't actually, the people that crossed the bridge before you were probably the ones that were fighting forward. There was a lot of fighting went on here, because the Germans were trying, I suppose, to defend their native land.
Now, one thing that people have noticed is that the Comet had a tendency to bog down more than the Shermans. Yeah. Did you find that? Could you comment on that?
I think the tracks weren't wide enough, really. But one of the things, I mean, if you looked at the Tiger, the tracks were about twice the width of the normal British tank. And I think the width of the track had some effect on it.
And that was more so than the Sherman?
Yeah, well, I think it probably was. There was quite a few incidents of bogging down in Germany.
What would you do when you bogged down? How would you get out?
You just have to wait till the LED come up. If you couldn't, if the tracks just wouldn't take you out, you just had to wait till you got a tow. On some occasions, though, another tank that was on high, dry ground could tow you out with you, a couple of tow ropes or something. You did things like that. You just, each occasion was sort of dealt with in this way.
Now, here the bazooka threat became real. I mean, from it seems to have done from the time you ended up in Germany.
Well, I never came across any, heard any much about bazookas, although they were used a lot in the Bocage country as well, because it was ideal for close range weapons. But Germany was terrible because they had something called the Volkssturm, which was like the Home Guard. And they were equipped with Panzerfaust or bazookas. And they had a tendency to be dug in a deep little hole at the side of the road. And when they heard the tanks coming, they would duck down. And you didn't know they were there until you were probably a few yards from them. And they knocked out one or two on the roads, not doing that. That was, bazooka was a deadly weapon here at close range. The only weapon that we had equivalent to that was the Piat. The infantry had that. A similar thing.
Well, now, you seem to have worked a lot with the infantry in Germany, much more than France. Or, well, could you comment on that?
Well, I think most of the reason was that it was a distance. The infantry, to save the infantry having to embark on trucks and things to catch up, you had your safety people, your infantry on your tank, or they go up to the front as quickly. And it was handy to have them there, because when you met an obstacle or they were fired on or something like that, the best people to clear it was the infantry on the ground. Well, I think that's the Herefords were with us most of the time, and you got quite a friendly atmosphere with sometimes there would be a rifleman on the front sitting and talking to the driver, and as long as there was no stuff flying about, it was quite friendly. Taxi service.
Now, what about the fighting? There seems to, the various things happen. Teutoburgo, Wald Ridge, and the rest of it. What do you remember? What are the things you remember from the?
I can't remember having any I wasn't in the Teutoburger range, I can remember. I might have been there in reserve.
I think it was mainly C Squadron,
I think so.
But what do you remember of the nature of operations in Germany then? What was it like?
Well, the country, some of it was very like Scotland, the wooded, big areas of larch and spruce timber. Well, Teutoburger was like that, and it was not very comfortable. You always felt the feeling that there was somebody watching, I don't think the country, the terrain, was much different from England or Scotland.
What about the state of the villages and the towns? What state were they in?
Mostly they weren't touched, you see. Except maybe the areas didn't bomb villages so much, but there were one or two damaged probably with fighter aircraft coming, you know, strafing them and that, things like that. But I think one of the villages we came into was Hamelin, you know, the famous thing. It had been attacked, one or two houses burnt out. Generally speaking, the habitation wasn't badly damaged in Germany.
What about the local population? How did they meet you?
You never saw them very often. If you saw anybody, you would be looking through closed windows and things, but you never, they didn't come out in the street much or anything like that. When we reached Winston, for instance, there was quite a lot of white flags hung out. I suppose the civilians thought this was a precaution against anybody firing anything at them. So that was my impression of Winston.
That's after you'd crossed Lüneburg Heath, you went into Winston, by the Elbe, I think.
Lüneburg Heath was after that, wasn't it? I'm not sure. And there were so many movements and places you passed through.
Actually, you went to Winston early and then you went back to Winston for a rest period, so yeah, it could be. Yeah. So any incidents you do remember?
Yeah, there was a nice big blonde farmer's wife came and said something to one of the boys who understood German. I can't remember. He spread the news that she had a bull and some cows that she was going to service with this bull, and everybody dashed into the farmyard and got into places where we could observe. And while we were all watching this ridiculous sort of thing, some criminals in the trucks or in the beer salon went into all the tanks and pinched all the loot. I lost several watches and two cameras.
How had you got that? The loot. What do I mean?
Well, when we passed through villages, we weren't supposed to do that. This was against all the regulations and whatnot. But I think most officers and I think some of them were busy looting away themselves. But when you went into the house, you just carefully looked into the drawers in case there were booby traps or anything like that. And, just some things in houses that you consider spoils of war, I suppose.
And what would you look for particularly?
Well, most people look for watches and cameras. When you've got prisoners, they're usually offered with their watches. They're so glad that they've finished with fighting and whatnot. Very often the prisoner would come in and hand you his watch. They knew you were going to take it from him anyway.
And what about the booby trap threat? Were you?
Well, we were told about this the idea was to keep people from going into houses and that. I never come across any house that was booby trapped.
So you just ignored it, the risk, really. Yeah.